Chapter 5 Science. The kiss is held in high sexual esteem among many nations, in spite of the fact that the parts of the body involved do not form part of the sexual apparatus, but constitute the entrance to the digestive tract. Sigmund Freud. Poetry, art, music, and literature attempt to convey, or at least to evoke for those who can recognize it, the thrill and the anguish of love. They do it with extravagant metaphors. I've got you under my skin. You are part of me. We two are one. My heart lives in thy breast as thine in me. The scientist looks on coldly, wary of being taken in by what may, after all, be nothing but delusion. Science aims first to make love unfamiliar. As inadvertently illustrated by Freud in the epigraph, estrangement can also work for comedy. If lover's spirit is heir to endless torment, the topological peculiarities of the digestive, excretory, and reproductive tracts provide comic relief. For science to speak of love is often thought to be comically inappropriate, if not positively offensive. The American Senator William Proxmire once mocked a scientific study of love, commenting that right on top of the things we don't want to know is why a man falls in love with a woman and vice versa. This reluctance to acquire scientific knowledge is something of a puzzle. It seems to apply to whatever is most highly prized, art, religion, and morality, as well as love. The fear is that to explain is to explain away, that scientific explanation will show our most cherished values to be illusions. How could it be, goes the complaint, that the wondrous feelings of love, the heroic acts motivated by love, the lifelong source of joy that love sometimes affords, how could it be that all these can be reduced to facts about brain circuits or neurotransmitters? The bogey of reductionism is an old story. John Keats, poet of love and ecstasy, is reported to have deplored Newton's discoveries about the prismatic character of light because it amounted to unweaving the rainbow. Like many others since, Keats seems to have thought that understanding a phenomenon is like finding out how a magic trick is done. Once you know, the magic is gone. But is the opposite view not more attractive? Why should more knowledge mean less pleasure? Once you know the origin of the rainbow, you have two things to enjoy instead of one. First, the astonishing power of different hues to make white light and of raindrops to refract them apart. Second, the fascination of an unanswered question. How exactly does the physical nature of light explain our sensations? Just as the beauty of the rainbow is unspoiled by the physical laws that explain it, so the beauty of the beloved is surely untainted by its origins in our nature as evolved animals and social beings. The role of brain chemicals in implementing the resulting human powers will only add to our stock of mysteries to wonder at. Now you can contemplate not only the wondrous fact of the beloved's beauty, but also the amazing way it came about. This response may seem unpersuasive. Few would claim that the beauty of the rainbow is destroyed by understanding. In the case of love, as in the case of moral goodness, you may be more reluctant to accept that qualities you revere or values you hold dear exist only in virtue of physical or biological mechanisms. The worth of what we love feels undermined if our reverence is merely a projection of our psychological makeup resulting from some neural mechanism shaped by mindless natural selection. The feeling might be at least partly mitigated by recalling that no one approach can capture everything we think or want to know. The reduction of complex phenomena to simple laws is the standard aim of science. Every chemical reaction, for example, can be fully explained in terms of the physical laws that govern the particles forming the substances involved. But even a cynic who believes that love reduces to chemistry doesn't mean it in the sense that chemistry reduces to physics. Although mechanisms of biological processes are chemical and physical, other perspectives are needed to explain why these mechanisms exist in the first place and what role they play in our lives. That calls for evolutionary theory, anthropology, psychology, sociology, none of which reduce to chemistry or physics. So it is misleading to think that scientific scrutiny of love will reduce it to mere physical processes. No good scientist would be rash enough to claim that we can fully explain every nuance of feeling and experience in terms of the underlying state of our brains. At least not yet. But just as knowledge of physiology can be useful in planning an exercise regimen, so knowing something about how love is implemented in the brain might help us to manage our love lives. Shedding light on the brain states that implement the bliss and the agony of love might empower us to lessen the agony and enhance the bliss. Botanizing love. Science affords many perspectives and methods, ranging from the mere collection of unconnected observations to the elaboration of unified explanatory theories. Collecting observations is a good way to start, and much of what I have been doing in this book so far is just that sort of botanizing. A well-tried second step is to sort them into types. That isn't always easy because the items collected are often disparate or their descriptions contradictory. The third step is to construct a theory capable of explaining the underlying mechanisms and reconciling the apparent contradictions. The obvious place to look for observations about love is literature, where we will find, in addition to subtle and moving insights, an abundant stock of clichés. Philosophers are prone to promoting clichés to the status of normative definitions, that is, definitions that tell you not what a word means, but what it ought to mean. In Chapter 2, for example, we encountered the observation that inspired the Aristophanic myth, "Love is longing for union with the beloved." I venture to guess that you, dear listener, have no more of a clue than I do about what that could mean. Sex is one possible answer, but sexual union doesn't require love. So sex can hardly be the defining feature of love. A desire for union may also characterize the obsessive stalker, but that too, surely, is far from what is meant. Will the union longed for consist in having all the same thoughts, in finishing one another's sentences, in resonating to the same music? An intense desire to share pleasures is common between lovers. The desire to share pain only slightly less so. But the longed-for union may be no more than a sort of mutual hallucination of communal consciousness. One day, technology may enable us literally to share experiences. Kevin Warwick, an English engineer, has already succeeded in perceiving his wife's sensations by means of implanted electrodes that transmit signals from her nervous system into his own over the internet. For most of us, however, union would require proximity as well as a continuing intimacy. And yet, there are examples of lovers. Violetta in Verdi's opera La Traviata comes to mind, whose love is expressed by leaving her lover for his sake, precisely because she loves him. If true love were a craving for union, that plot would make no sense. Perhaps, then, it is the altruism of Violetta's motive that better captures the essence of love. As we have heard, the altruist's dilemma would stump pure altruists, if any such could be found. If, however, you are genuinely determined to let your beloved's preferences trump yours just in case of conflict without demanding reciprocation, that won't trigger the dilemma. It sounds like true love indeed, even if the bargain is one-sided. But what if your beloved is anorexic or suicidal? Should you, having undertaken to regard all her desires as your own, encourage her self-destruction? Or should you not, rather, if you love her, respect her interests more than her possibly delusive desires? This raises the question once again, who is the authority on our authentic desires? Is there a best kind of love in which the answer to that question is obvious? Typologies of love. Perhaps the answer is simply that it depends. There are different kinds of love and different kinds of lovers. Typologies of love may help to sort it out. There have been a number of such typologies. I will give two examples. Either one can make a fun parlor game, as well as providing a comforting sense, once you have filled out the right questionnaire, that you will know just what kind of a lover you are. John Allen Lee, a sociologist, suggested that we could distinguish six basic styles or colors of love. His styles can combine, rather as colors combine, in different proportions to make new ones, and thus the scheme allows for an indefinite number of finer distinctions. Two of Lee's six styles, agape and pragma, are too remote from the erotic forms of love to concern us here. Agape is indiscriminately altruistic and dissociated from sexuality. Pragma, while it may involve sex, is more about calculating the benefits of a relationship than about emotional bonds. Storge, the attentive listener will recall, is a compassionate affection that can be part of erotic love but can also exist outside it. That leaves Eros, which is the kind of love one falls in, sometimes at first sight. Lee uses the word Eros to refer to a kind of love that fits the target into a pre-existing ideal mold. Its variants include anxious and possessive mania, which is what I have been calling limerence, as well as ludus, the Latin word for sport or play. For the ludic lover, love is a game. Robert Sternberg is an American psychologist whose triangular model of love posits three basic factors, each of which can combine with the others in variable proportions. The three basic dimensions are labeled intimacy, passion, and decision/commitment. Each comprises a cluster of more specific feelings, desires, and behaviors. Intimacy includes feelings of closeness, desires for the other's welfare, and for sharing thoughts, feelings, and activities. It is marked by strong agreement with such statements as, "I have a relationship of mutual understanding with." Passion refers to intense preoccupation with the loved one, with sexual attraction and intense longing for physical and mental connection. People who get a high score on this factor will strongly endorse such opinions as, "I cannot imagine any other person making me as happy," or "there is something almost magical about my relationship." Decision commitment is at the third apex of the triangle, but confusingly, this dimension is made up of two items that are not equivalent. One might decide that one is in love with someone, yet not be committed. Such statements as, "I feel a strong sense of responsibility for," or "I would stay with through the most difficult times," will rate highly on this measure, as will, "I have decided that I love," despite the fact that such a decision does not necessarily bear on the long term. Mathematically, three factors in all possible combinations yield eight types, including the trivial non-love, which is the absence of all three factors. The maximal level of all three is consummate love, which is nice if you can get it. Among Sternberg's labels for the other combinations, some are more easily recognizable than others. Most people would regard empty love, defined as commitment without passion or intimacy, as having little to do with love. It seems, rather, to resemble just that dutiful conformity to the expectations of a conventional marriage that the Countess of Champagne thought incompatible with love. Liking is intimacy without passion or commitment, and infatuation is passion alone, without commitment or intimacy. Two-way combinations yield three more types. Companionate love, which is commitment and intimacy without passion. Fatuous love, which combines passion and commitment without intimacy. And finally, romantic love, the combination of passion and intimacy. Romantic love falls short of the ideal consummate love by missing out on commitment. Real cases vary indefinitely in the proportion of their ingredients. The typology, despite the rather arbitrary labels, therefore allows us to recognize almost anyone as somewhere on the map. The adult loving styles identified in Lee's and Sternberg's typologies have been found to relate to styles of attachment in infants, studied by child psychologists John Bowlby and Mary Ainsworth in the mid-20th century. The general idea is that the emotional styles of adults are required in paradigm scenarios, experienced first in early childhood and further shaped in childhood and adolescence. Among the original formative experiences that shape those scenarios are characteristic ways in which infants learn to respond to the level of attention they receive from their primary caretaker. From exhaustive observation of the interaction between infants and their caretakers, researchers distilled a threefold typology of attachment styles: secure, anxious, ambivalent, and avoidant. Secure children are confident of their caretaker's reliability. They do not fear to explore, returning only occasionally to refuel in the caretaker's close contact. Anxious children have learned that their caretaker is not altogether reliable. As a result, they exhibit ambivalence both about leaving and returning to their side. And avoidant children, who have been more consistently rebuffed or rejected, learn a sort of stoical independence which masks their insecurity and neediness, or perhaps altogether supersedes it. In infants, responses to abandonment by the caretaker tend to evolve from protest, manifested in searching behavior, crying, and refusal to be comforted by others, through despair, expressed in intense sadness, to detachment, consisting in avoidance of the caretaker when they return. When repeated, those patterns shape not only the infant's expectations of the caretaker's responsiveness, but also her own self-concept as a person capable or incapable of eliciting appropriate care. In this way, an infant's paradigm scenarios contain an embryonic caste list, comprising both her role in others' lives and that of others in her own. The adult forms of these attachment styles are not difficult to discern. Anxious, ambivalent styles of attachment typically result in the anxiety and exaltation of limerence, which fits the profiles of Lee's manic style and is related to both Sternberg's infatuation and his romantic love. Prominent characteristics of this style include a longing for unrealizable merger, a greater incidence of extreme emotions, such as intense jealousy, a more anxious felt need for reciprocation, and intolerance of loneliness. Secure styles of attachment are recognizable in the adult's erotic storgic style of love, or in Sternberg's consummate or companionate styles. These are less obsessive and richer in positive emotions of friendship, intimacy, and trust. The avoidant style results in fear of intimacy and lower levels of trust and acceptance of the partner's flaws, but it also shows more emotional self-reliance and a tendency to envisage life without a love partner as desirable and fulfilling. The three styles are also found to differ in the durability of their most important relationships, with an average of 10 years for the secure type, but only about 5 or 6 years, respectively, for the avoidant or anxious types. Although neither Lee nor Sternberg discuss the duration of their principal styles, the question of how long love is likely to last is an important one. In short, there are recognizable styles of love tied not only to individual temperament, but to paradigm scenarios formed very early, which give us a repertoire of stories and dramas into which we cast both our loved ones and ourselves. The same Robert Sternberg has cataloged a great many scenarios to which people fit their own lives and, more dangerously, other people's lives as well. Examples are the fantasy story, the business story, the horror story, the humor story, the police story, the collector story, and many others. Each story is defined by a set of beliefs and expectations about how a relationship should proceed and what is important about it. The humor story demands that you see the comical aspect of your disagreements. You should be able to laugh at the way your quarrels illustrate classic clichés, and your shared laughter should be the basis of your intimacy. The police story involves endless surveillance, either enforced or expected, depending on which role you cast yourself in. And so on. Where the two partners' paradigm scenarios are compatible or complementary, the partners may enjoy enduring happiness. But since all of us approach our relationships with unconscious paradigm scenarios firmly in place, it is easy to see why lovers' arguments are as unpersuasive as they are intense. How could you fail to see how that would hurt me? How can you possibly not understand? The answer is always the same, though it is seldom made explicit. Because I have not studied your script, and you are failing to play your assigned part in mine. What about the brain? In the work mentioned so far, what passes for the science of love has been grounded in the subjective reports of experience, supplemented, in the case of attachment theory, by plausible speculation about how natural selection is likely to have shaped us. But since the advent of brain imaging technology, peering into the brain has come to seem the royal road to understanding the mind. These techniques include electroencephalography, EEG, positron emission tomography, PET scans, magnetoencephalography, MEG, and magnetic resonance imaging, MRI. All have disadvantages. Of the two most prominent technologies, for example, MEG has good temporal but poor spatial resolution, while the reverse is true of MRI. What counts as good spatial resolution currently involves precision to about 1 millimeter. This may seem less impressive when we remember that a cubic millimeter might contain 1 million highly complex neurons, each of which talks to several thousand others. Furthermore, brain imaging is unreliable. In one notorious case, an MRI scan detected brain activity in a dead salmon. It has been estimated that over half, perhaps as many as 95% of published findings based on brain imaging are later invalidated. So it is probably wise to greet the accelerating flood of news from the brain with a measure of skepticism. Nevertheless, affective scientists have found solid evidence of the distinctive phases of both the bliss and the torments of love. According to Jak Panksepp, one of the field's pioneers, each reflects the activity of a coherent system of neural, hormonal, and behavioral patterns rooted in the subcortical part of the brain. The working of those systems is coded for by genes that we share with other mammals. They involve specific brain anatomy, neural circuitry, and hormonal chemistry. Panksepp has identified four such systems. The two that concern us here he calls the seeking system and the panic system. The seeking system causes primitive responses of joy. The panic system, despite its name, is not to be confused with the fear system. In this terminology, panic is not an extreme form of fear, but signals the loss of a target of attachment. It is first aroused by abandonment in the infant, producing intense distress and triggering activity in the brain circuits involved in physical pain, which is why analgesic opiate drugs also afford relief for the pain of exclusion or separation. Not everyone experiences love in the same way. Although our brains are very similar to those of other primates, the stories in terms of which we make sense of our lives and passions are constructed with words on the basis of complex social learning. The original impulses that provide them with their power no more define their meaning than a dancer's anatomy explains the meaning of a dance. That is why, on the basis of broadly common brain organization, we get a multiplicity of love stories or scenarios. If love's various syndromes originate in the deeper layers of the old brain, it is not surprising that brain regions activated in mothers of infants bear striking similarities to those of adults in love. Researchers used MRI machines to compare brain activity in mothers viewing pictures of their children with those of persons thinking about their beloved. Although they found differences, there was significant overlap in the brain regions involved. The overlapping regions included those rich in receptors for oxytocin and vasopressin receptors. Those are the neurotransmitters that have been found to be implicated in the reward system. That system, as we heard, is normally linked to pleasure, and its function is to increase motivation to repeat the behavior that triggered it. Closeness and caresses, both in lovers and in mother and child, tends to strengthen their affectionate bonds. More tellingly, both forms of love deactivated regions of the temporal cortex and prefrontal lobe associated with rational thought and critical judgment. If we are to infer anything from these findings, it can only be, as so often happens, something we probably knew already. Love of infants and erotic love are different in some ways, but alike in others, including the property shared by a number of drugs of impairing judgment and making us just a little bit more stupid. Complementing imaging studies of the brain, scientists are currently exploring the chemistry of love. This refers principally to the type of neurotransmitters that are implicated in feelings of love, but also to the molecules that are transmitted from one person to the other through taste and smell. The role of smell is distorted by the perfume industry, notably because of that industry's lucrative preoccupation with the elimination of natural bodily odors. But its importance to natural selection is amusingly attested by the t-shirt sniffing test. Men were asked to wear the same t-shirt for 2 nights while refraining from soap, deodorant, and garlic. The t-shirts were then sniffed by female subjects. Providing that the women were not on the pill, they preferred the odor of men whose genes coded for a type of major histocompatibility complex, MHC, different from their own. MHC genes affect the organism's capacity to discriminate between self and non-self, and hence the efficacy of our immune system in warding off infectious diseases. Kissing provides similar information. When you kiss someone new, you are also sensing their chemical suitability as a mate. Perhaps, on learning about these findings, you may begin to share the discomfort of those millions of other people who would prefer not to know why they fall in love. You might then feel even more uneasy about other animal studies, which cannot fail to be extended to humans sooner or later, that hint that the difference between monogamy and promiscuity might be entirely a matter of chemistry determined by genes. The montane vole and the prairie vole are closely related species which differ radically in their mating behavior. The prairie vole forms a monogamous bond at first mating. The male helps to rear pups by licking and nest building. Montane voles mate with multiple individuals, and the male makes no contribution to the rearing of pups. In the absence of vole marriage laws, the difference suggests an underlying chemical mechanism for monogamy, controlled by a small genetic difference. And that is exactly what has been found. Scientists have identified not only the neurotransmitters responsible for the prairie vole's commendable fidelity, but also the specific gene that programs them. Lacking this gene, the pleasure taken by their montane cousins in their first experience of sex does not induce them to form an exclusive bond. The brain chemistry involved appears to work as follows. The rewarding character of sex is related to the release of dopamine, but singling out a particular partner as its cause requires an additional factor. In the montane vole, mating is presumably rewarding, but not tied to any one individual mate. The additional factor appears to be contributed by two other chemicals. These happen to be ones that we have already encountered as active in mothers and limerent lovers, oxytocin and vasopressin. If the pathways for these are blocked in the prairie vole, bonding with a particular sexual partner does not occur. Those chemicals have no effect on the montane vole because it lacks the appropriate receptors in the relevant regions of the brain. Oxytocin has acquired some notoriety for its role in flooding the brain in orgasm and in childbirth, in generating trust when sprayed up people's noses, and even in diverting the attention of men from attractive women other than their partner. When receptors for those chemicals are blocked in the prairie vole's brain, it behaves more like a montane vole. Amazingly, manipulating the regulation of a single gene in the montane vole will make individuals more likely to form monogamous attachment. Control over the expression of genes responsible for regulating chemical pathways in the brain can make a montane vole monogamous and a prairie vole promiscuous. So far, we have seen intriguing observations, plausible typologies, and potentially unsettling findings in brain science. We still lack a comprehensive scheme to explain how these all hang together. Three syndromes of love. All the studies mentioned assume that love is, at root, adaptive. From the evolutionary point of view, love is about mating, and mating is ultimately about gene replication. The connection with our own goals is, at best, indirect. Gene replication is not the right kind of thing to count as a reason to love. In a metaphorical sense, it is a goal of nature. Its only goal, in fact. But the goal of nature is not ours. Nevertheless, we can understand something about the origins of our own desires by asking what nature needs to get us to do for the sake of her goal. The mechanisms used to secure gene replication are astoundingly diverse, but in animals like us, efficient mating must accomplish four subtasks. The first three are entrusted to adults: actual mating, sexual intercourse, assortment, mate choice in the medium term, and collaboration between the mating partners for as long as it takes to launch the offspring into independence. The fourth subtask is to secure for the helpless infant a mutual bond with a caregiver. Setting aside the last, which does not involve erotic love, the three subtasks are affected by three syndromes of love: lust, limerence, and attachment. Psychologist of love Helen Fisher has studied these three syndromes at great length, and she has found that the implementation of each one is characterized by distinct patterns on each of four different levels: A, the type of love experience it gives rise to; B, the selective pressure arising from the need to optimize the subtask; C, the principal neurotransmitters involved, and D, the length of time it typically lasts. 1. Lust. A. The sex drive is experienced as a drive to mate with almost any conspecific who is available and at least semi-appropriate. B. In order to get the job done and perhaps avoid being surprised by a predator, the drive is for immediate sexual intercourse. C. Its dominant neurotransmitters are a combination of androgens, testosterone, and estrogens. But dopamine, which is associated more widely with the energetic pursuit of immediate goals, is also involved. D. Its duration is measured in minutes, or at most, in hours. 2. Limerence. A. The intense, obsessive, romantic love for which I have adopted the usually specific word limerence is akin to Lee's manic erotic style or Sternberg's pure passionate style. Intense forms of it are most likely to strike those who have preserved in adulthood the anxious, ambivalent attachment style. It involves obsessive and exclusive preoccupation with the lover, longing for their constant presence, and highs and lows triggered by overinterpreted signs of reciprocation or rejection. Although often condemned because of its disruptive effects, limerence has been observed in most societies. It exhibits no gender differences and can be regarded as a gender equalizer in that men who experience it are commonly described as being conquered, defeated, or brought low by their love. B. The biological function of limerence is to form a particular mating pair bond. It has been honed by selection to save time and energy by concentrating attentions on a single individual. That is supposed to explain why exclusiveness in both sex and emotion is such a distinctive feature of limerence. Once the limerent phase is over, by contrast, exclusiveness is commonly felt as obligation rather than preference. Limerence is associated with Panksepp's seeking system. Its principal neurotransmitters are catecholamines, norepinephrine, and dopamine. D. Its typical duration is measured in weeks or months, up to a maximum of 3 to 4 years. It is no coincidence that the 3rd and 4th anniversary of a marriage or love partnership is when it is most likely to break up. 3. Attachment. A. This love syndrome is commonly, but not necessarily, sexual. The feelings aroused by the target's closeness tend to be of comfort, security, and calm, rather than ecstasy and obsession. Thus, it is often felt much more intensely in the pain caused by loss of the beloved, governed by Panksepp's panic circuit, than in pleasure afforded by her presence. B. The function of attachment in reproduction is to keep the pair together for a more extended period. That is, at least for the length of time required to bring offspring to independence. The mechanism used to secure this end may have roots in the process that secures the bond between infant and parent. C. Its characteristic neurotransmitters are, once again, oxytocin and vasopressin. These chemicals have many other functions, but they play a crucial role in determining mating patterns in other mammalian species. D. The typical duration of attachment is indefinite, which again confirms the hypothesis that it is built on the basis of childhood habits, forming paradigm scenarios or model love stories. Hence, the typical duration of attachment is reckoned in years rather than months. In some cases, a smooth transition occurs between the natural end of limerence and a lasting attachment combined with occasional lust, blessing those lucky few who boast of a continuing love after decades of a happy marriage. Together, the distinct psychological profiles of lust, limerence, and attachment, with their respective brain chemistry and typical durations, suggest that some ways of fitting each into a life plan might be more judicious than others. Apart from their different shelf life, each has distinctive characteristics that potentially alienates it from the other two. Only attachment can be cemented over time by shared experiences, forming the historical dimension of love. Only limerence is inherently exclusive, although even limerent persons can love others, children, parents, or friends, but only rarely other lovers, in non-limerent ways. Only lust is commonly fungible. By nature, lust carries no requirement of exclusiveness. So while it is true, as unreflective common sense assumes, that love can endure for a lifetime, that truth depends on masking the ambiguity in the word love. It is likely to be true only when attachment has successfully taken over from limerence. These facts cast light on the question of whether love is socially constructed. Even if each of the three syndromes of love is enabled by our brain's chemistry, it is ideology that determines when one will be recognized as experiencing true love, and it is a widespread social fact in our culture that one is not entitled to claim to be experiencing true love unless one is subject to all three syndromes of love at once. Unfortunately, the differences in duration, if nothing else, virtually guarantee that this will hardly ever be the case for long. Love debunked or science demoted? Classifying types of love is fun, but explains little. At best, typologies of love give you a comforting feeling of recognition, but if you didn't already think you knew yourself, you wouldn't have anything to recognize. So, that feeling of insight may be as illusory as that which some people find in astrology. When those typologies can be linked to real knowledge, however, they may actually explain something. The appeal to paradigm scenarios or stories of love is a case in point. The idea that each lover is locked inside a script that the other hasn't seen may actually explain why lovers get into such trouble when they argue. Even you, dear listener, must have had the experience of finding that considerations entirely compelling and logical were found wholly unconvincing by the beloved you were attempting to persuade. The idea that we enact stories of love linked to early attachment styles has empirical support, and the information about brain processes implementing the experiences of love has the potential to advance understanding. At the very least, it suggests patterns of correlation between love and other systems of feelings, attitudes, and behavior. At the same time, the findings of neuroscience carry a faintly menacing aura. For once we know how a certain function is implemented at the chemical level, the possibility of manipulating that function cannot be far behind. If we do attain such powers of manipulation, can science tell us how they might be best exercised? Assuming that best here is short for most likely to result in happy lives, science can surely disclose facts about human nature that we would do well to take into account when designing social arrangements. But we must be cautious about accepting too readily whatever scientists tell us. Not so long ago, it was a matter of scientific record that homosexuals were, if not actually sick, at least a lot less happy than heterosexuals. Since homosexuals were unhappy, the reasoning went, homosexuality should be suppressed, or at least discouraged. This reasoning failed to take account of an alternative hypothesis, namely that being the target of contempt, discrimination, and violence is not conducive to happiness. The history of scientific forays into gender differences of emotional styles is littered with similar delusions, which usually just happen to confirm widely shared prejudices. Historians of psychology have detailed the many attempts to find differences between male and female brains, in brain weight or volume, in neural connectivity, in functional lateralization, to name but three, to explain an assumed inferiority of women. When one difference failed to be confirmed, scientists just looked for another. At least half a dozen books published in the last few decades by respectable evolutionary psychologists provide ingenious explanations for non-existent facts. To cite just one example among many, several of these books tell us that the logic of natural selection makes it inevitable that male and female jealousy must be quite different. Given the facts of reproduction, the reasoning goes, it stands to reason that men must fear for their paternity, while women fear loss of paternal cooperation. That looked very plausible until it was shown that this supposed effect of natural selection actually fades with increased socioeconomic gender equality. It may well be true that men are more distressed by a woman's sexual infidelity, but that could be an effect of the stereotype rather than its justification. It is part of the commonly assumed ideology that women's sexuality is less urgent than men's, and that a woman would not be interested in sex unless she were emotionally engaged. So, even if the stereotype is entirely false, a man who believes it may infer from that false stereotype that a woman having sex with another person does so out of emotional attachment. In this way, the self-reports that seem to confirm the hypothesis of the evolutionary psychologists rest on the spurious theory that is wheeled in to explain them. The ideology of love and sex is conveniently self-reinforcing. As for the belief in a weaker sex drive in women, it is worth noting that this is only about 200 years old. Earlier in Western culture, women's sexuality tended to be viewed as rampantly insatiable. Alexander Pope summed it up in two lines: men, some to business, some to pleasure take, but every woman is at heart a rake. That attitude has long been reflected in the chronic savagery with which women's sexuality has been repressed and punished, not only by cultural institutions, but by physical interference such as foot binding, chastity belts, and genital mutilation. A multiplicity of syndromes. Despite these reservations and the caution they suggest we should exercise before accepting the latest scientific pronouncement on love, the theoretical framework provided by Fisher's threefold distinction can be very useful. The theoretical perspective it provides can lead to a salutary reappraisal of the sort of animal we are and of the many different things it can mean when we say we love. It can also give us guidance about the practicalities of love and sex, if only by explaining why they are sometimes so difficult to manage. From the point of view of evolutionary theory, the conflicts suffered by lovers are not surprising. Nature is indifferent to us and to our happiness. To natural selection, individuals and individual love are of no importance so long as genes get replicated. As the philosopher Schopenhauer put it, that this particular child shall be begotten is, although unknown to the parties concerned, the true end of the whole love story. The manner in which it is attained is a secondary consideration. From the point of view of an individual human being, of course, the manner in which it is attained is everything. Our own aims in love are bewildering in their variety and commonly paired with the aim of thwarting the goal of nature by artificial means of contraception. From this brief survey of scientific approaches to love, as well as from the failure in the last chapter of all efforts to find any convincing way in which reasons are involved in love, we can conclude that our efforts to make sense of love are unlikely to succeed in bringing us into any simple harmony with nature. A more thorough review would have to take account of social sciences, including history, if only to remind us of the relativity to social context of institutions and practices that we tend to regard as deriving from natural necessity. Is one form of relationship more likely than others to be felt as satisfying and fulfilling? This is a question one might hope to answer on the basis of empirical evidence. There is no shortage of contemporary advice givers, each of whom promises their own snake oil, urging you to live as they prescribe. Like religious sects, they seldom agree, and each is probably right about the worth of all the others. At the risk of seeming to do the same, I must now confront the normative question. Given what we know about love, what ought we to do about it?